Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with a Colorado Sun. It's Wednesday, January 4th. Today, reporters Jen Brown and Elliot Wensler discussed the anniversary of the Marshall Fire, which burned more than 1,000 homes and killed two people in Boulder County 1 year ago. Before we begin, the Colorado Sun needs your help to support visual journalism at the Sun. The Sun's photographer, Olivia Sun, is a Report for America Corps member. Report for America is a nonprofit organization which places talented emerging journalists into local newsrooms. Any contributions help continue the program. To learn more, visit coloradosun.com/RFA. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day, in 1941, a contract signed in Washington, D.C. authorized construction of one of the nation's largest armament facilities, the Denver Ordnance Plant. The works contributed to Colorado's dramatic growth during World War II, as civilians and military personnel alike flocked to the Centennial State to help the U.S. build up its defenses against the international threats of fascism and totalitarianism. In 1940 and 1941, most Americans preferred to stay out of the conflict raging in Asia and Europe. Nonetheless, President Franklin D. Roosevelt called for preparedness in case the United States got drawn into the fight. To that end, the U.S. Department of War contracted with the Remington Arms Company to manufacture small arms and ammunition. The January 1941 contract, announced by U.S. Senator Edwin Johnson, authorized $122 million to purchase a site, erect a factory, and commence production. Surveyors selected the Hayden Ranch, southwest of Denver, and the first phase stood complete by October. When Japan attacked Pearl Harbor 2 months later, the Denver Ordnance Plant had already produced 14 million rounds. By 1943, it employed nearly 20,000 people and operated around the clock, producing millions of rounds a day. The Denver Ordnance Plant closed in 1944, but private manufacturers operated at the site until World War II ended. The government retained most of the property, and during the Cold War turned it into the Denver Federal Center, the largest assemblage of national government offices outside of D.C. Now surrounded by Lakewood, the Federal Center remains a major source of employment in Colorado. Before we continue, a quick message. Join the Colorado Sun for its 2023 legislative session preview. On January 11th, join politics reporter and editor Jesse Paul as he speaks with lawmakers about the upcoming session. The event is free and virtual. Sign up today at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
This is Jennifer Brown at the Colorado Sun, and I'm here with my colleague Elliot Wensler. And both of us spent a lot of time in the last couple weeks reporting on the anniversary of the Marshall Fire, which we all recall was a pretty awful day in Boulder County. More than 1,000 homes destroyed, two people were killed, multiple businesses destroyed by this super fast wind-whipped fire that went through Superior and Louisville and parts of Boulder County. And, you know, they're still investigating how that fire started. And it's been, you know, a long year for those people who lost their homes and were displaced renters as well, I should mention, who've been struggling to find a place to live since then, and people dealing with smoke damage and all kinds of things. So we did a really complete report, a series in the Colorado Sun, kind of exploring where the community is at, you know, a year after this fire, which happened December 30th, 2021. So Elliot is here with me to talk about her story, and we're just kind of chatting about what we've learned now on the anniversary of the fire.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And Jen, let's start with the story you worked on. You were part of a team that helped follow a few of the families who lost their homes and checking in on their progress since that fire. What have you learned about how they're doing?
Yeah, you know, when the fire first happened and, you know, everything's kind of a whirlwind, and we interviewed a lot of people who were, you know, frankly, probably in shock, like their whole life just kind of literally went up in smoke. You know, they lost everything that they had. And we decided then that we wanted to keep track of people over the course of a year, kind of check in with them every 3 months or so and see where they were at. And, you know, it was really interesting to do, because at first it seemed like everyone was like, you know, we lost all of our neighbors and friends and sense of community, like in a matter of hours. And everyone was so determined, it seemed like, to rebuild that, like to come back to their same lot, rebuild it. They wanted all their neighbors to come back too. And it was interesting to see how that evolved over time. One family in particular that I checked in with, you know, at 3 months, 6 months, you know, a year, they kind of changed the course. You know, at first it was like, we're going back, you know, we're almost 100% definite, we're going back. And they immediately found a place to rent. But you know, everything gets more difficult. And they realized that it would take maybe years to rebuild on their same piece of property. And, you know, first of all, it took like months just to get the piles of ash and twisted metal and, you know, stuff that was on their property cleared off. And then it was like the process of getting a permit and finding a builder. And in the meantime, you know, this family with two kids is in limbo in an apartment that was too small and just didn't feel like home, and they were away from their school. And at the 6 month mark, basically, they found a house to buy and basically gave up on their plan to move back home. And of course, we talked to others who, you know, are decided that moving back home is still the only thing they wanted. So they're still working toward that. But no matter how much will, I guess, everyone had to rebuild the community the same as it was, it's just pretty obvious that something as devastating as, you know, a massive fire that destroys like entire subdivisions, like you're never really going to be able to recreate what was lost.
And what do we know about where things stand for that community, and you know, how many homes are in the process of being rebuilt, or what do we know about that?
Well, in total, they counted 1,084 homes that were destroyed in the fire. So one of the first steps is getting a building permit to rebuild. And I think the building departments in Louisville and Superior and unincorporated Boulder County have just been swamped, right? And that process can take weeks, if not months, to get your permit reviewed. You have to deal with, you know, how you're going to get utilities. And sometimes when you're in a rural area, that's even more complicated. You have to provide all the building plans. And so, you know, people are deciding, like, are they going to hire a custom builder and design their new home how they want it? Are they going to join with half a dozen other families to use the same builder? Or, you know, are developers going to come in and make, you know, kind of the standard subdivision, like the way these were built in the first place, with building a whole bunch of homes together for cheaper for people to buy, which could take a long time. So they have all these decisions facing them. But we found out that, you know, as of last week, out of those more than 1,000 homes destroyed, there was 170 permits that had been issued, you know, so you're still like 800 or 900 of these homes that were destroyed still don't have like a permit, which means, you know, building has obviously not started. So, but, you know, we did find some people who are, you know, kind of at the leading edge of rebuilding. You know, there's homes with siding up and roofs going on and, you know, windows coming. And we interviewed some of those families. And really, I learned that, first of all, they were extremely decisive. Like, their house burned down, they decided to rebuild their house. And immediately they were, like, one family I talked to, they're having coffee with a custom builder, like, in January, you know, within a couple of weeks of losing their house. So that's kind of how they got on the forefront of rebuilding. So those first, I think there's been one home so far that's been completed and the person has moved in, one that we've heard of. And we interviewed a few people who have move-in dates at this point for around midsummer, July. So there's still a lot to go. And in the beginning, they said this could take, you know, 3 years, and it seems like that's about right.
I'm curious, Jen, is it difficult to track where all of the people who are affected by this end up? And if they are, if they are in fact rebuilding, or if they don't, it seems like it would be hard to keep up with where folks end up. Is there any entity that's like tracking where everyone goes?
Yeah, that's a great question, because no, there's not. I mean, there's no central spot that's like, oh, this many people move back to their homes and are rebuilding, and this many people like bought in Broomfield or, you know, moved away. Like, no one really knows the answer to that. So really the best way to do it is look at these building permits. And also, you know, another thing that was telling is looking at the number of vacant lots that are for sale. So, I mean, that obviously means those people are not rebuilding on their property and they've decided to purchase elsewhere or do something different. And there's actually quite a lot of lots. Like we found 74 active listings in Superior and Louisville. So that's like a ton for that community. Like normally you'd see like basically zero lots because it's those are kind of built out. You know, it's pretty rare to find a vacant lot in a subdivision in one of those towns where you could, you know, put up the house of your dreams or whatever. So, but the thing is, they're not really moving. They're sitting on the market for 100 days, 200 days, like a long time. We found that 36 of the lots in two of those towns had sold. You know, a couple years ago, it was like six. So you're seeing that the market is flooded with these lots. And, you know, it's just, it's really interesting when you think about like, on one hand, like, I guess what an opportunity that is, right? Superior and Louisville are really desirable towns for families, especially. And it's rare that there would be a lot for sale. On the other hand, there's just so many questions about how you rebuild like Coal Creek Ranch subdivision. Like the whole thing is basically destroyed. We're only a few houses standing. And what does that subdivision look like? Like it was pretty uniform before it all burned to the ground. So if you have all these different people coming in and buying up lots, you know, and they have custom builders, like do you end up with weirdly shaped homes or, you know, what does that community look like? Are the home values much higher because the houses are bigger and, you know, better, or what does it look like? So I think that they're really going through a time of determining like what stuff is worth, I guess. You know, I thought one story I heard from a realtor I interviewed was very interesting. He was saying that, you know, he had a house for sale in Coal Creek that basically to get to it, you had to drive through all these burned out lots, and the house did have smoke damage, but it was fully mitigated. But people, you know, he was really worried he'd have a tough time selling this place because just who knows what this neighborhood is going to become. And do you want to live in a place where all the other houses are burned down, you know, forever, however long that takes to rebuild. So, but anyway, I mean, this is Colorado, right? The housing market is crazy everywhere. And, you know, he ended up selling the house within a few days for, you know, over $1 million and 200,000 more than the asking price. And he found the right buyers for it. And basically, he was optimistic about what the neighborhood would become someday. So anyway, it's going to be an evolving story for years, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's good to hear that he's optimistic about it. And that even in light of this, there are folks who are wanting to start community there.
Tune in again tomorrow for more on the Marshall Fire. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. The governor's staff is proposing a new state office that would be responsible for addressing school safety issues across Colorado. The Office of School Safety would provide school safety grants and training to districts. And there would be a focus on helping rural districts that often lack the resources to handle lengthy grant applications or provide adequate security or mental health services to students. The Office of School Safety would cost about $2 million per year and would absorb all existing state school safety resources. The state legislative session opens January 9th. A pilot's error in judgment is to blame for a 2020 plane crash near Telluride that killed a young couple. The National Transportation Safety Board report found the 30-year-old pilot tried to fly a single-engine propeller plane into an area with tall mountains before gaining enough altitude. The crash happened at 11,823 feet on Black Bear Pass, which is just southeast of Telluride. The pilot and his wife, who both worked for United Airlines, were killed in the crash just days after they flew to Colorado to get married. The Environmental Protection Agency is investigating whether Colorado's regulation of air pollution from industrial facilities discriminates against Hispanic residents and other racial minorities. According to a letter released last week, federal investigators said they will scrutinize the state's oversight of Colorado's biggest polluters, including the Suncor oil refinery in North Denver, and whether the effect of that pollution on the largely Hispanic residents is discriminatory. Colorado officials said they welcomed the EPA review, more community participation, and are reviewing their permitting policies to ensure they are focused on environmental justice. For more information on all these stories, visit our website, www.coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. The Colorado Sun is nonpartisan and completely independent. We're always dedicated to telling the in-depth stories we need today more than ever. And the Sun is supported by readers and listeners like you. Right now, you can head to coloradosun.com and become a member, starting at $5 per month. And if you bump it up to $20 per month, you'll get access to our politics newsletter, The Unaffiliated, as well as our outdoors newsletter, The Outsider, and our new health and environment newsletter, The Temperature. All three exclusive newsletters delivered to your inbox every week.